This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio. Welcome back to Case Closed. Thanks for joining me this Wednesday for another 60 minutes of old-time radio crime. We begin this week with Sherlock Holmes and the Sussex Vampire, his episode from December 14th, 1947. After that, it's the Secrets of Scotland Yard and the Bank of England robbery. That episode aired October 5th, 1953.
From New York, the makers of Clipper Craft Clothes for Men and 924 leading retail stores from coast to coast present the world's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes. Our stories are based upon the character of Sherlock Holmes created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Sherlock Holmes is portrayed by John Stanley, Dr. Watson by Alfred Shirley, and the dramatizations are by Edith Meiser. Winter's certainly here, Dr. Watson. There are snowdrifts 3 to 4 feet high piled outside your door.
Let me take your galoshes, Mr. Harris, while you warm your feet by the fire.
Boy, this feels good. I think I'll just dig in here for the winter, Doctor.
Well, why don't you?
And hear a Sherlock Holmes adventure every evening. Say, come to think of it, that would have the good old Arabian Nights beat all hollow.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. A very neat compliment indeed.
Well, Dr. Watson, which of your many Sherlock Holmes adventures have you decided to tell us this evening?
Well, to tell the truth, I was in a quandary as to where to begin until I received a communication by this afternoon's post. Oh, here it is.
Thank you. Wedding announcement. Gloria Waverly Pembroke to Juan Fernando Ferguson. See, that's a strange combination of names. Juan Fernando Ferguson, Doctor?
Yes, Juan Fernando Ferguson was the victim in the case of the Sussex Vampire, although he was hardly a year old at the time.
The case of the Sussex Vampire? That sounds promising. Just what is a vampire, Dr. Watson?
That's the exact same question that Holmes put to me at the beginning of this case. Oh, but before we go into the subject, suppose you say a few well-chosen words on another subject. A subject we're very pleased to hear about on this program.
Thank you, Dr. Watson. A few words that give you the whole story in a nutshell are these. Clippercraft clothes are the best values in suits, topcoats, and overcoats you've ever seen. Now, you have every right to say to me, how do you explain that, Mr. Harris? Tell us what makes it so. Well, explaining Clippercraft's great values is simple as ABC. They're planned values. They take advantage of all the ingenuity their makers can bring to bear. The Clippercraft plan concentrates the buying power of 924 leading stores across the nation, making tremendous savings in manufacturing and distribution costs. You get the savings this brilliant plan makes possible. What's more, you get them at your own local independent store, at the store you can trust. Until you see them, you wouldn't believe such beautifully tailored suits were possible at only $40 and $45. Such handsome topcoats and overcoats at only $40. Clippercraft values are so downright remarkable. We urge you to compare them with clothes selling for many dollars more. Now, Dr. Watson, to return to the case of the Sussex Vampire.
It was a blustery afternoon, Mr. Harris. Early in November in the year, let me see, somewhere early in the 1900s. Well, at any rate, I had returned to our rooms in Baker Street to find Holmes standing before the huge reference books he had compiled for himself, the volume V in his hands and a quizzical look on his face.
Ah, there you are, Watson. You look a trifle windblown.
Well, it doesn't take any brilliant deduction on your part to ascertain that fact, my dear Holmes. What a gale. It fairly tears the coat off your back. I had to chase my hat almost the entire length of Kensington Gardens. Oh, I'm completely exhausted.
Oh, nonsense. A little strenuous exercise is good for you.
Oh, yes, then why don't you indulge in it more frequently?
I don't need to. My waistline isn't becoming unmanageable.
Well, there's nothing matter with my waistline. A bit more substantial than yours, perhaps, but it's...
Watson, Watson, stop your spluttering. I haven't time to listen. We've something more serious on hand.
Oh, I say, a new case?
I haven't decided. Watson, in your own invaluable opinion, just what is a vampire?
Oh, I thought you didn't have time for any tittle-tattle.
I haven't. My question's entirely serious.
A vampire? Oh, well, a vampire's supposed to be a sort of walking corpse that lives by sucking human blood and can only be held in its grave by a stake driven through its heart. It's a purely legendary figure, like werewolves and sea serpents.
Exactly. A childish bugaboo. Pure rubbish.
Yes, just the result of a lot of ignorant peasants frightening each other. Their imaginations run away with them. Hocus-pocus like that could never become current in England.
No? Superstition's a difficult thing to stamp out. Read this letter.
Oh, what is it? The hysterical ravings of some neurotic female?
On the contrary, it's a business letter from Morrison, Morrison & Dodd, one of the oldest and most reputable law firms in the city. Read it.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes, in Re Vampires. Sir, our client, Mr. Robert Ferguson of Ferguson & Muirhead, tea brokers of Mincing Lane, has made some inquiry from us concerning vampires. As our firm specializes upon the assessment of machinery, the matter hardly comes within our purview, and we have therefore recommended Mr. Ferguson to lay the matter before you.
The question now is, does it come within our purview either?
Well, we seem to have been switched into Grimm's fairy tale. We may as well expect a witch on a broomstick to come flying down the chimney.
Oh, well, anything's better than stagnation, eh, Watson? Besides, stamping out superstitions, one of my hobbies. Now what? Come in, come in. Oh, good afternoon, Mrs. Hudson.
A letter for you, sir. Came by the late post.
From Mr. Robert Ferguson, Cheeseman's, Lamberley. Thank you, Mrs. Hudson, thank you.
Don't mention it, sir.
Well, this Mr. Ferguson, he doesn't seem to have lost any time in getting in touch with you, Holmes.
Well, the matter must be fairly urgent. Cheeseman's, Lamberley. Where is Lamberley, Watson?
In Sussex, south of Horsham.
Read the letter, there's a good fellow.
Oh, really, Holmes? You're becoming more indolent every day.
Rubbish. Just because I sit here relaxed with my eyes closed doesn't mean I'm not mentally alert. But get on with the letter, get on with it.
Well, wait a minute, can't you? We'll wait till I get it out of the envelope. There we are. My dear Mr. Holmes, I have been recommended to you by my lawyers, but the matter is so delicate I hardly know how to explain it to you. Some 5 years ago, I married a South American lady, the daughter of a Peruvian merchant. She's very beautiful and a most loving wife. But I cannot help feeling that there are sides of her character which I can never explore or understand. A few months ago, she began to show some curious traits quite alien to her ordinarily sweet and gentle disposition. This is my second marriage. I have one son by my first wife, charming and affectionate, but a cripple. Twice my wife was caught in the act of assaulting this poor lad in the most brutal and unprovoked way. That was a small matter, however, compared with her conduct to her own child, a beautiful boy just under 1 year of age. The story, if true, is almost too horrible to mention. One afternoon last week, I heard my older boy screaming upstairs. Almost immediately, the baby's nurse burst into the room and begged me to follow her as my wife was in one of her spells.
Let me go. Let me go. You're hurting me. Oh.
Oh, Mr. Ferguson, sir, come quick. It's your wife. She's took bad again.
What?
She's beating the boy. Oh, hurry, sir. Or she'll kill him.
Good heavens, this is dreadful. Come along, nurse.
You're twisting my arm. Oh, stop hitting me. Stop.
I'm coming, Jackie. I'm coming. Tina. Tina, let the boy go. I say, let the boy go.
Father, look. Father, she hit me. Look there.
Why, you've raised a great welt on his arm. This is too much, Tina. Are you going crazy?
I hate him. I hate him, the little beast.
After all, Tina, he is my son and a cripple. How can you be so inhuman?
It is because I love you. Don't you understand? I would sacrifice myself rather than break your heart. You must believe me. You must trust me.
Yes, but what do you want me to believe?
I cannot tell, but you must trust me.
After all, actions speak louder than words. How can I believe you love me when I see you torturing my son?
I hate him. Take him away. I will kill him next time.
Stop it. You're delirious, that's it. You're delirious. Don't you think so, nurse?
It's worse than that, sir. She's possessed of the devil. She and Dolores, that blackguard maid of hers. Dolores practices strange rites up in her room. She's a voodoo, I tell you.
Oh, nonsense. This is going too far. Has the whole house turned into bedlam? Really, nurse, Dolores is from Latin America. Just because she does things you don't understand doesn't make her a witch. It's all quite easily explained.
There's something going on in this house you can't explain so easy, no matter how you try.
What do you mean?
What I saw in the nursery this afternoon, just before she started into beating Jackie.
Oh, don't tell. You promise not to. Oh, for the love of heaven, don't tell.
Tina, be quiet. What did you find, nurse?
I was out in the back hall, warming the baby's bottle, when all of a sudden I heard a loud cry, like he was in pain. I ran in to find out what the matter was. And there she was, leaning over the baby. I screamed. She looked up. And there was blood on her face. She's a vampire. That's what she is, a vampire.
Thoroughly unsavory, Watson. Go on with the letter.
Ever since then, the nurse has guarded the child day and night. And day and night, the silent, watchful mother seems to be lying in wait as a wolf for a lamb. For the rest, she confines herself to her own room and will see none of us. I know this will all sound most fantastic to you, Mr. Holmes. Vampirism in the heart of Sussex. And yet I beg of you to take it seriously. If you would only come down and investigate the matter, a child's life and a man's sanity may depend upon it. Yours faithfully, Robert Ferguson.
Well, Watson, what do you make of it?
Well, it all sounds like a nightmare to me. Maybe the man himself is demented.
Possibly, Watson. Possibly. Suppose we visit Lamberley tomorrow afternoon to see if we can get to the bottom of this strange case. I've always wanted to meet a vampire. Ah, yes, that must be our client, Mr. Ferguson, waiting at the other end of the platform.
You mean the long, slab-sided man with loose limbs and a splendid back? Well, he looks prematurely aged.
An experience like this would add years to any man's looks. Ah, Mr. Robert Ferguson, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Holmes. I received your telegram. I can't begin to express my gratitude.
Quite, and this is my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson.
Oh, how do you do, sir?
I believe we've met before, Dr. Watson.
Oh, really?
Aren't you the same Watson who played rugby for Blackheath while I was three-quarter for Richmond?
Bobby Ferguson, why, of course.
Yes.
I'm delighted to see you again, old fellow. I never forget the day you threw me over the ropes into the crowd at Old Deer Park.
Yes, yes. Time has changed us both. Whoever would have thought we would meet again under such tragic circumstances. But come, the carriage is waiting over here.
So, Watson, you played rugby, eh?
No, indeed he did, and a splendid athlete he was, too.
And see that? You're full of surprises, Watson. There are unexplored possibilities about you.
Oh, now you're pulling my leg, Holmes.
Now, here's the carriage. Will you get in first, Mr. Holmes?
Thank you.
Now, Watson.
Righto.
That's right. And tuck this rug in around your knees, will you? The wind is getting rather brisk. Looks as though we'd have a storm before night. All right, Wilson. Let's get along.
Now then, Mr. Ferguson, if you don't object to a few personal questions...
Oh, no, anything, anything. What can I do? I can't go to the police with such a story. And yet I must protect the children. Is it madness? Is it something in the blood? Have you ever had a similar case? Oh, for the love of heaven, give me some advice. I'm at my wit's end.
Gently, Mr. Ferguson, gently. Now, just pull yourself together and give me a few clear answers. I can assure you that I am very far from being at my wit's end. First of all, have you spoken to your wife since the discovery?
No. No, Mr. Holmes. She refuses to see me. Her maid, Dolores, who's been with her since she was a child, is the only person she will see.
I gather that you did not know your wife well at the time of your marriage.
Only a few weeks.
Then your wife's character would be better known to her maid than to you.
I suppose so.
This unhappy lady has appeared to assault both the children, her own baby and your son?
Yes. She attacked Jackie again just day before yesterday.
But the assaults take different forms, do they not? She has beaten your own son.
Once with a stick and once very savagely with her hands.
The lady jealous by nature?
Well, she is a Latin American. She has a fiery, tropical nature.
Quite. But the crippled boy, he's 15, I understand, and probably very bright mentally, since his body isn't as active as other boys. Did he give any explanation of these assaults?
No, he declared there was no reason.
Were they good friends at other times?
No. No, there was never any love between them.
And yet you claim he's affectionate.
Well, I've never seen a more devoted son. He's absorbed in everything I say or do.
Most interesting. Were the attacks on the baby and your son at the same period?
In the first case, yes. It was as if she were seized by some frenzy and had vented her rage on both. In the second, it was only Jackie who suffered. And possibly because nurse kept a strict watch over the baby.
I see.
Ah, but here we are, Mr. Holmes. Cheeseman's. The old houses in this part of the country are still named after their original builders.
Yes, I see a rebus of a cheese and a man on the ancient tiles that line the porch. The middle section of your house is very old, Mr. Ferguson.
Yes, the wings are newer.
Very interesting building with its towering Tudor chimneys and its lichen-spotted roofs.
If you will come in, sir, I can offer you some refreshment.
That will be most welcome. My bones are chilled. Wind's rising. That storm can't be far off. Look at those clouds.
Well, reminds one of the riders about carriers, eh, Ferguson?
Oh, come in, Watson. Come in and shut the door.
All right.
That's better.
Now, if you'll just... Oh, Dolores.
Si, senor.
Dolores, bring some sandwiches, will you? And have the windows shuttered. It looks as though we're in for a storm.
Si, senor. I shut them after I order sandwiches.
That is your wife's maid, I take it.
Yes.
Handsome girl, but a bit primitive, eh? Ah, I see your iron fire screen is dated 1670.
Oh, yes. We've got a great mixture of dates in this room. The half-paneled walls may well have belonged to the original yeoman of the 17th century. And the watercolors hung along the lower part are obviously modern.
And the collection of weapons and utensils nailed against the yellow plaster.
Those are the oldest of the lot. Inca Indian relics, I believe. No one knows how old they really are.
I see.
My wife brought them from Peru. This quiver, for instance.
Most enlightening. Most enlightening.
Hello. Hello, here comes Carlo. Well, how's the boy? Come here.
Nice-looking spaniel, Ferguson.
Hello.
What's the matter with the dog's hind legs?
Oh, that's what's puzzled the vet. It seems to be a sort of paralysis. Spinal meningitis, he thought. Come here, boy. Come on. Ah, it seems to be passing off. He'll be all right soon, won't you, Carl? Won't you, boy?
He knows we're talking about him. Look at him thump his tail.
Did this paralysis come on suddenly?
In a single night.
How long ago?
Several months.
Very remarkable. Very suggestive.
What do you see in it, Mr. Holmes?
The confirmation of my suspicions.
What are your suspicions, Mr. Holmes? It's just an intellectual puzzle to you, but it's life and death to me. My wife's a victim of some terrible curse. My child is in danger. Oh, don't play with me, Mr. Holmes. It's all too horrible.
Calm yourself, my dear fellow. Keep a stiff upper lip. You may have to bear still greater pain, I fear, but I'll try to spare you as much as possible. I hope to have a solution before I leave this house tonight.
Ah, the storm has broken at last. I say, listen to the rain.
Yes. I got the shutters closed just in time.
Thunder, by Jove, at this time of the year.
It's a thoroughly bad night.
Sandwiches, senor.
Oh, yes. Come in, Dolores, and put them there on the table. Careful. Why, you almost dropped the tray. What's the matter, Dolores? Why, you look as if you'd seen a ghost.
I frightened. Listen, you hear that storm? It the great dogs of death howling round this house. My mistress, she very sick. She no take food. I frightened to stay with her without doctor.
I shall be glad if I can be of service.
Would your mistress see Dr. Watson?
I take him. I not ask leave. She need doctor.
Oh, then I'll come at once.
You're sure you're not afraid? My wife may be really dangerous.
Oh, rubbish, Ferguson. I can take care of myself.
What you've a right to expect in clothes costing many dollars more is yours in Clippercraft, at just a fraction of what you'd expect to pay. You get long wear that results from fine materials and good workmanship. You get good taste. Correct styling is worn by the world's best-dressed men. And you get comfort and perfect fit from skilled designing and precision tailoring. American production genius applied to the making of clothes makes this possible. That and the unique Clippercraft plan concentrating the buying power of 924 of the nation's leading stores from coast to coast. You get the savings that result from this group buying at your own local independent store, at the store you can trust. Clippercraft suits are only $40 and $45. Clippercraft topcoats and overcoats are only $40. Selling expensive clothes at inexpensive low prices at the nation's finest independent stores is the great big idea behind the Clippercraft plan. That's why men who know insist on Clippercraft clothes. So be sure to visit the Clippercraft store in your city.
The leading stores in the metropolitan area that bring you Clippercraft clothes are Saks 34th, Broadway at 34th Street, Manhattan, Abraham and Strauss, Brooklyn, the Boulevard Men's Shop, Kresge, Newark, Newark, New Jersey, and the B&B Clothes Shop, 16408 Jamaica Avenue, Jamaica. These great, courteous, and friendly stores are proud to add their names to that of Clippercraft in the label of your suit, top coat, sports jacket, and overcoat.
I wish Watson would come back. He's been gone over half an hour.
He's all right. If anything had gone astray, I should have heard it. I've been listening.
Oh, so that's what you've been doing. You were so quiet, I thought you were dozing.
Wait. Something now. Listen.
I can't hear anything but the rain.
It's coming this way. Hear it?
Oh, yes, yes, now I do. That's Jackie's cane, poor fellow. He's coming in here.
It's the spine that's weak. I can tell by the limp. Excitable, too. Shh, here he is.
Oh, Father. Father, I didn't know you were back. I'd have been here to meet you. I thought you were out in the storm. Oh, I'm so glad to see you.
Gently, gently, Jackie, please. Don't hug so tight. There, there, now, that's better. We have company. This is Mr. Holmes.
Hello, Jackie.
Sherlock Holmes, the detective?
That's right.
Oh.
Now that I've met your eldest son, Mr. Ferguson, may I make the acquaintance of the baby?
Why, certainly, Mr. Holmes, certainly. And just wait till you see him. How anyone could have the heart to hurt him. The most beautiful baby.
So that's it.
What did you say? What's the matter? Why are you looking out the window like that? What do you see?
The solution of this crime.
Yes, but the windows are shuttered.
Quite.
Well, I may say you gave me a start.
I'm sorry?
Oh, not at all. My nerves are a bit on edge. What with this situation and the storm. Jackie, go upstairs. That's good, fellow. And ask nurse to bring the baby down here, will you?
Yes, Father.
Has it ever occurred to you, Mr. Ferguson, that this story about your wife's peculiarities might have been made up by the nurse to get revenge on her for some slight?
Oh, impossible. In the first place, I saw her beat the boy with my own eyes.
Yes, but the other...
Oh, no, no. Unfortunately, I feel that must be the truth, too. Nurse is a good woman with plenty of common sense. She's always been very fond of my wife and the baby. I'm sure she'd never have told me if she'd not felt it were necessary to protect the child.
Yes, I thought so. However, we were bound to consider every possibility. You never know.
Help! Help! She's killing him!
Hello, what's up?
Hurry, Holmes! Hurry!
Coming, old chap, coming.
Oh, this is terrible.
What's up? What's happened?
Mrs. Ferguson, her bedroom door was open. She saw the boy go into the nursery. Quick as a flash, she was out of the bed and into the other room.
Oh, it's awful. There was Jackie standing beside the crib playing with the baby when she comes in, raging like a tiger, shoves him aside, snatches up the baby, and dashes into her own room before you can wink.
Oh, quick. We must get the baby away from her.
The door's locked. We can't get in.
Break it down, then. Help me, Watson.
One, two. Stop!
Get out of the way, Dolores.
You know, take one step or I shoot.
Tina, look at her. She's got the baby.
In heaven's name, don't take the baby away from me. Please, don't take it.
Stand back, you not touch her.
Go ahead and shoot. I'm going to save my baby.
Easy, Ferguson, easy. Dolores, would you mind pointing that revolver in some other direction? I know your intentions are good, but your nerves are a trifle unsteady.
Look at my wife, the murderess.
Mr. Ferguson, it seems to me that your wife is a very good and a very ill-used woman.
How can you stand there and say that? Look at her. Blood on her lips. She's killing him.
Has it ever occurred to you that a wound may be sucked for some other purpose than to draw blood from it?
What do you mean?
To draw poison from it. Your wife has been risking her own life to save your child.
Poison?
Quite. The South American household has weapons on the walls. When I saw that empty quiver, I was sure. If the child were pricked by one of those arrows dipped in curare or some other devilish drug, it would mean death if the venom were not sucked out.
You mean Tina's knife?
I see, of course. Why, it's quite obvious.
And the dog. If one were going to use such a poison, wouldn't it be wise to first try it on the dog to make sure it hadn't lost its power?
Oh, yes. But who could have done it? I don't understand.
If I tell you, I must wound you very deeply in another direction.
Oh, no. No, you must not tell him. You must...
Darling, darling, what does it matter as long as you're cleared? Don't you understand? Nothing else matters.
Oh, Robert.
But why? Why didn't you tell me?
Your wife knew how much you loved your other son. She was afraid it would break your heart.
Jackie? My Jackie.
Oh, Robert. You must not be sad. He's jealous, just a child. You will get over it.
Yes. Yes, we'll help him. Together. Oh, my darling, I'm so glad it wasn't you.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Oh, there, darling. Don't.
Come, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. Your work is finished. They no longer need you.
Yes, but, Holmes, don't you think we ought to...
And Dolores is right. Come along, Watson. At this particular moment, we're decidedly de trop. Why, that's a pretty harrowing story, Dr. Watson. Did Jackie recover his mental balance?
Oh, yes, indeed, Mr. Harris. They sent him around the world with a good tutor, sea air... Marvelous for adolescent nerves.
Yes, Doctor, but how did Holmes know it was the boy?
You remember his saying he saw the solution of the crime in the shuttered window pane? Well, Mr. Harris, what he really saw was the reflection of the boy's face when his father affectionately mentioned the baby. Holmes caught a glimpse of such jealousy and cruel hatred as one seldom sees on a human face.
Well, Dr. Watson, that certainly is a thrilling story, and you certainly know how to tell it.
To paraphrase my friend Sherlock Holmes... Elementary, my dear Mr. Harris. Elementary.
And what story are we to have next week, Dr. Watson?
Well, next week I think I'll tell you how Holmes and I spent the Christmas holidays at Pendragon Castle and became involved with a ghostly lady in white, the Honor of the Nevilles, and a Father Christmas who, quite unexpectedly, sang bass.
Makers of Clipper Craft Clothes and 924 leading stores from coast to coast have brought you another in the new series of broadcasts featuring the world's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes is produced and directed by Basil Lochran with special music by Albert Berman. If you don't know your Clippercraft dealer, write Clippercraft, 200 Fifth Avenue, New York City. Lives are lost needlessly every year when people die of tuberculosis. You do your part to prevent tuberculosis when you buy and use Christmas seals. And be sure to do your Christmas mailing early. Be sure to listen next week to Sherlock Holmes in The Adventure of the Christmas Bride. If you'd like to attend the Sherlock Holmes broadcast in New York, see your local Clippercraft dealer, and he'll tell you how to obtain your tickets. This is Cy Harris speaking for Clippercraft Clothes. This is the world's largest network, serving more than 450 radio stations, a mutual broadcasting system.
How do you know? Is there such a thing as the perfect crime? If so, it's no place in this program. For we're concerned with the majority of crimes, the imperfect ones. And yet, every so often, there comes a crime so very near to perfection that the criminals themselves must have believed at one stage of the game that they would really get away with it. And yet, invariably, they were wrong. Such is our case today. A classic in the annals of the tricksters. You've heard the expression, safe as the Bank of England. For more than a century, that expression has signified the stability of a great British institution. Stability, yes, but invulnerable, I wonder. The title of this program is The Bank of England Robbery. Standing on an island site in the heart of the city of London is the home of the old lady of Threadneedle Street. For this is the affectionate name by which the Bank of England is known the world over. Her stone walls are guarded at night by a company of guardsmen, and her gold and good name are guarded by day by the vigil of the clerks and managers. This is as true today as it was equally true almost 100 years ago. The time is the year 1873. Strolling along a city street in the summer of that year are two men. One is an inspector from Scotland Yard. The other is the famous American detective Arthur Pinkerton, who was over in England at the time in connection with some investigations for one of his American clients.
Oh, a beautiful day, Inspector Shaw.
Yes, Mr. Pinkerton, you've certainly brought the fine weather with you.
I guess it's just a fallacy in America, but we always believe you have nothing but rain and fog in England.
Well, I certainly wouldn't like to conceal anything from you, Mr. Pinkerton. And we do have our fair share of fog and rain, but all the same, I think...
What? Wait a minute.
What is it?
See those two fellows ahead of us?
What, you mean those two businessmen?
Yeah. And unless I'm very much mistaken, they're in a pretty queer business.
Oh, can't say I recognize them. Hey, look, they're crossing the road.
Come on, we'll keep on this side, but try to draw level.
No, they're strangers to me.
But not to me. Unless I'm very much mistaken, their names are George Bidwell and George McDonald. Bidwell has been mixed up in crime all his life. McDonald is a convicted forger. Both of them are well-educated and will stop at nothing. I didn't know they were in England.
Well, thanks for the information. Oh, by the way, Pinkerton, do they specialize in any particular type of crime?
Yeah, robbing banks.
Inspector Shaw arranged for the men to be shadowed. For the next few months, Scotland Yard kept a close watch on their movements. As an additional precaution, Scotland Yard sent a circular letter to the London banks, warning them of the presence of Bidwell and MacDonald in Europe. However, the majority of the banks had their own system of precaution, and the bank managers were not very impressed.
Another of these circular letters from Scotland Yard. I don't know what they take us for. Bunch of fools, I suppose. A couple of American tricksters over here. I suppose they think they can get away with the sort of trickery they use in New York. Oh, they get a surprise if they try it over here. I'd like to see them try it.
His wish was to be fulfilled. The months went by, and no more news was heard of Bidwell and MacDonald. They both went over to the continent, and Scotland Yard gave up their watch. Then, a few months later, Scotland Yard received an urgent message from the Bank of England. Thank goodness you're here, Inspector. Immediately my attention was drawn to this forgery, I sent for you personally. I felt that if any man could help us, it'd be you.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Mr. May. Well, now, suppose you give me all the facts of the case.
Well, this morning, I had a message from Colonel Fraser, who is the manager of our West End branch. Among the bills cleared by him yesterday were two notes to the value of £1,000 each, in the name of a very respectable financier, Mr. Blydenstein.
You mean that these notes were signed by Mr. Blydenstein and were, in fact, promissory notes to the value of £1,000 each?
That is correct. Each notes such as these, provided they are genuine and signed by a reputable banker or financier, are accepted by the Bank of England as full security. In fact, just as if they were actual money.
And in due course, these bills go through to Mr. Blydenstein, who pays them, and the transaction is completed.
Yes, of course. Such bills are usually post-dated. In fact, that is the reason they're lodged with the bank. On the date stated, they would go to Mr. Blydenstein, who would pay up.
And these bills were, I presume, credited to the account of one of your customers at the West End branch?
Yes. The account of a Mr. Warren, a businessman of considerable interest. He's an American.
Oh, an American. You say he has considerable interest. Has he had the account of the bank for a long time?
Not a very long time. No, I've had a talk with Colonel Fraser, and I gather, in point of fact, he's only had Mr. Warren's account for about a year. But that, of course, is explained by Mr. Warren being an American. He's over here in connection with the construction of the new Pullman trains. He's having a number of these trains built in Birmingham for use in England and on the continent.
Oh, how did you know this?
He told Colonel Fraser.
I see.
I should not want you to think that Colonel Fraser relied on Mr. Warren's word concerning his stability. During the past year, a considerable amount of business has gone through his account. I need hardly add that there's been no grounds for suspicion in connection with Mr. Warren's account. We've had bills against some of the most reputable bankers and financiers in Europe, including Rothschild. And in every case, the bills were genuine, because they've been met.
Yes, but this one against Mr.
Mr. Blydenstein.
Yes, this is a forgery.
That is correct. And the awful thing is that we might not have known it for some time if it hadn't been for the mistake.
No, oh, what mistake?
Well, I told you, these bills were made out to be payable on a certain date.
Yes.
Well, on this particular bill, there was no date. It was noticed by one of the clerks, and Colonel Fraser sent it round to Mr. Blydenstein to have the correct date added. It was then we learnt it was a forgery.
When did Mr. Warren hand this bill into the bank?
He didn't actually hand it in. I understand that he's been away in Birmingham for the last few months, and he had been in the habit of sending bills by registered post.
Sending bills? Oh, in fact, you mean that he's made a habit of this sending bills?
Yes.
And what's the state of his account?
Well, there's about £5,000 in it. A very considerable amount of money has passed through the account in the past few months, and most of it has been withdrawn through checks made payable to a Mr. Horton, who has an account at the Continental Bank in London.
Mm-hmm. And what money has been paid into Mr. Warren's account to meet these checks?
Not much money. Most of it is represented by bills which will fall due during the next few months.
Oh. And in the meantime, the Bank of England has credited Mr. Warren. About how much money do these bills represent?
Well, I've only glanced at the figures, but I should estimate it must be something in the neighborhood of £100,000.
£100,000. Mr. Warren didn't do things by halves. Immediately, Scotland Yard acted. Obviously, the account at the Continental Bank, in the name of Horton, was the means whereby the criminals were extracting the money. On the very day while Mr. May and the inspector were visiting the Continental Bank, a young man came in to cash one of Mr. Warren's checks.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I've come to cash this check.
Oh, thank you. If you'll just wait one moment, will you, sir?
Yes, that's the account.
All right, Mr. May.
Just one moment, please.
Yes? Anything the matter?
I'm a police officer. If you'd accompany me to the manager's office, I'd like a word with you. The young man, whose name was Noyes, turned out to be the clerk to Mr. Horton. He denied all knowledge of the plot and said that he'd only been in Mr. Horton's employment for a matter of months.
We've checked up at the lodging house where he's staying, and I gather that he talks quite freely of his post with Mr. Horton.
When did he meet Horton?
Who evidently put an advertisement in the newspaper saying that he was seeking a situation and could put up some money as a guarantee of his being trustworthy. He gave Horton £150 to keep in trust. Needless to say, Horton has disappeared. All the same, I don't quite trust Mr. Noyes. I think he knows more than he's saying.
Further inquiries reveal that Noyes had come from America and that he'd arrived only 6 months ago. Pinkerton, the American detective, was now back in New York and acting on behalf of the bank. He helped Scotland Yard with information they urgently needed. Pinkerton advised London that a relative of Noyes had received that same month a draft for £1,000. For a junior clerk, Mr. Noyes was very well paid.
It's no use, you know. You'd better tell us the truth. Where did you get this £1,000?
What £1,000?
Did Horton give it to you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Where is Horton? I warned you before, you'd do well to tell all you know.
But the gang had chosen well. They knew that Noyes would keep his mouth shut. Already, however, the gigantic proportions of the crime had aroused the indignation of the country. It transpired that every one of the bills held by the Bank of England were forged. All the genuine bills that had been passed through the account of Mr. Warren during the previous year had been used by the gang both to create confidence in Mr. Warren's stability and to act as a basis for the forgeries they were planning to carry out. The Bank of England, to use an American expression of a different generation, had been taken for a ride. Needless to say, Horton, Warren, and every trace of the money had completely disappeared. The hunt was on. Feat of detection on the part of Scotland Yard and Pinkerton to identify Horton and Warren as George Bidwell and George MacDonald. The only pity was their previous warning to the London banks was not taken a little more seriously.
We know for certain that MacDonald left England before the very first forged bill was lodged at the bank. He was taking no risk. He went to France, and so far we haven't picked up his trail. But we've reason to suspect, however, that he's headed for South America.
But what about the money?
That isn't going to be easy to trace. After Noyes cashed a check at the Continental Bank, he took the banknotes to the Bank of England and exchanged them for gold sovereigns.
Surely we can find this hoard of gold?
Hold on a minute. I believe they changed the gold back into notes, back into gold sovereigns, and then into American bonds. One can't help admiring their thoroughness.
I really cannot share your admiration.
No, Mr. May, I don't suppose you can. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that if MacDonald has got away, Bidwell is still in this country. We're having every port watched, and we're putting our own Scotland Yard men to keep an eye on the American boats. I don't think he'll get away.
George Bidwell was a man of infinite resource. He actually followed Noyes on his visit to the bank on that ill-fated day. And he'd seen him come out, accompanied by a police officer, and immediately realized that the game was up. To endeavor to get out of England in any ordinary way was out of the question. Although Bidwell was only some 40 years old, he'd spent the greater part of his life dodging the police of various countries. Having destroyed all the evidence at his lodgings, He made his way to one of London's great railway stations. He took the precaution of having a porter buy his ticket to Dublin, and then, quote his own words,
I intended taking the 9 p.m. mail train, and as a precaution, I waited until the last moment after the passengers were on board and the waiting room doors shut. As the mail was being transferred from the wagons to the train, I took the opportunity to walk through the big gate unobserved amid the rush and confusion. The car doors were all locked, but on showing my ticket to a guard, he let me into a compartment, no doubt supposing that I had obtained admission to the station from the waiting room and had been loitering about. The same was probably the case with the two or three other men looking out of the waiting room window at the platform, whom I judged to be detectives. The train rolled out of the station, and soon I was leaving London behind at the rate of 50 miles an hour. After midnight, we took the steamer to Holyhead and arrived at Dublin about 7 a.m. I should not have felt so comfortable throughout this night's journey had I known that the telegraph was flashing in all directions.
£500 reward for the capture of George Bidwell, who is supposed to be one of the persons engaged in the Great Bank forgery. He is an American citizen, about 40 years of age, a dark complexion, and is alleged to be an Irishman.
Bidwell went on to Cork, and as he left the station, was followed by two detectives. One of them inquired whether he'd ever been there before. With a haughty yes, he walked slowly away. He made his way to a wharf where a tender was waiting to convey passengers and mail to the liner SS Atlantic.
On entering, I found the place crowded and the tugboat ready to convey the passengers to the steamer Atlantic. Before attempting to step aboard the tug, I took a look around and saw my two detectives standing back in one corner with their eyes fixed on me, all but their heads being concealed behind the crowd, waiting to see their friends off for America. Apparently unconscious of their presence, I threw my papers one by one down among the passengers. And as the deck of the boat was 8 or 10 feet below, the detectives could not see to whom they were being thrown. I stood leaning on the rail for a short time, gazing at the scene, then left the wharf, not even glancing in the direction of the detectives. I felt that any attempt of mine to embark would precipitate their movement. Therefore, I at once abandoned all ideas of taking passage for Queenstown.
Bidwell was luckier than he realized at the time. On that trip, the Atlantic struck a rock off the coast of Nova Scotia, and of 1,002 people aboard, 560 lost their lives. All the rest of the evening, George Bidwell spent in trying to shake off the detectives who were shadowing him. Quite likely, these men were only acting on a general suspicion and did not care to take any definite action till they were made more sure that he was the wanted man. He stayed that night at a commercial hotel. When he went to the post office, where he'd arranged to collect mail in the name of Bodle, he realized that he was being watched. He hired a jaunting car and set off to the country.
Sure, you're a nervous man, sir.
Nervous? Why should I be nervous?
And why should you tell me in any case? You need not be frightened of me, sir. There's many a true patriot in Ireland that's nervous these days. I know you are a patriot, sir, and there are many doing what you're doing.
How do you know I am?
Trust in me. There are many in Ireland who will protect you.
When they reached a small town, Bidwell dismissed the jaunting car and decided to stay the night at an hotel. Glancing at a recent paper in the sitting room, he learned for the first time that his real name was known to the police, and that he was suspected to be in Ireland.
Baltimore Hotel, utterly dumbfounded, bewildered, paralyzed. I'd experienced some shocks, some takedowns in my time, but never one to compare with this. Arousing myself from a state of mental stupefaction, hitherto unknown, I put the paper into the fire and retired to the room allotted to me.
But in the morning, he was off on the road again, posing as a Fenian, an Irish revolutionary. He managed to make his way to Dublin. He put up at a small hotel and might well have escaped attention if he hadn't left behind him his scarf with the initials GB. This was seen by one of the maids.
I found this in his room, sir. He must have left it out when he was packing.
Ah, this is our man, all right. I want every man you can spare to watch all the trains from Dublin tonight.
Very good, sir.
He must not get away. He must not get away.
But he did. To Belfast, where, pretending to be a Frenchman, he managed to get on a boat to Glasgow. From there, he went on to Edinburgh, where he posed as a German medical student. For over 3 months, he lived there, corresponding with friends in America and successfully concealing his identity. Every day, he went for a brief stroll to buy the latest Edinburgh and London papers. The newsagent, not entirely taken in by Bidwell's disguise, felt there was something suspicious about his customer. He happened to mention it to another customer who worked for a firm of lawyers. And among the clients of this firm of lawyers was the Bank of England. By such a slender chain of circumstances and luck, information concerning this mysterious stranger came back to Scotland Yard. Bidwell was followed. He took flight, tried to get away. This time, he did not succeed.
I tell you, I'm no Fenian.
I know that.
Then what do you want me for?
For forgery.
I don't know what you mean.
I think you do.
Meantime, the arrest of the other principal in the conspiracy was no less tinged with melodrama. There was a worldwide hue and cry. In America, Pinkerton was leading exhaustive inquiries into the background of the gang. A trail, in the end, led to Cuba, where other members of the gang were found and arrested. As for MacDonald, he fled aboard the liner Thuringia, and his arrest was only achieved after a melodramatic boat race in the New York Harbor. And what of the loot?
Among the few clues which had not been destroyed by MacDonald and Bidwell was a letter which mentioned a certain Major Matthews. With this name as our guide, we went through the shipping records of every mailboat company. And at last we found trace of a trunk of clothing which had been sent to the depot of the North Atlantic Express Company in New York to be called for by Major Matthews. Wrapped up in the soiled linen were found 3 bundles of bonds to the total value of almost $300,000.
Those of you who are inclined to think that the modern criminals know more tricks than their predecessors, remember this amazing story occurred in 1873. When the various accused came to trial in August of that year, there was such a vast array of evidence against them that there was little to be said in their defense. It says much for their characters that they were principally concerned in seeing that the innocent did not suffer for their actions. Bidwell spoke of the manager of the West End branch of the Bank of England.
I should like to say concerning Colonel Fraser that I hope as the years go by, his resentment against me will wear away. I know a lot of people have blamed him, but I should like to say that any other man in London, however able, had he been in Colonel Fraser's position, would have been deceived by us. I'd like to say how sorry I am that he was deceived. That is all I have to say.
The commercial world was horrified by the revelation that the greatest bank in England could be tricked, deceived, and despoiled. In those days of harsh sentences, the criminals could have little hope of mercy. On the 8th day of the trial, after the men had been found guilty, the Lord Chief Justice proclaimed sentence.
You, who now ask for mercy,
and who are not restrained by respect for law and honesty must be met with a terrible retribution. And it should be well known that persons who commit crime, which only persons of education sometimes commit, will be sure to meet with a very heavy punishment. I cannot see a reason to make a distinction in the sentence I am about to pass. In regard to that sentence, if I could conceive any case of forgery worse than this, I should have endeavored to take into consideration whether such punishment, less than the maximum, might have been sufficient. But as I cannot conceive a worse case, I see no reason for mitigating the sentence. That sentence is that each and all of you be kept in penal servitude for life. And in addition to that sentence, I order that each one of you shall pay one-fourth of the costs of the prosecution.
Twenty years were passed by before the last of these criminals was released. Bidwell lived to write the story of his infamous crime. As for the rest, there's the rest. Have you noticed one thing about this story? At each stage, the almost perfect crime was spoilt not by the vigilance of the bank or the law, but by those little errors which, as we've learned in this series, time after time, give the criminals away. If Bidwell had been a little less greedy, he might have escaped. Remember, those two bills which led to their downfall were not detected because they were forged, but because he'd forgotten to fill in the date. Again, after all Bidwell's ingenuity to avoid arrest, he put the police on his trail in Dublin by forgetting to pack his scarf. The Bank of England robbery was called the crime of the century, but like most other crimes, it was far from being perfect. Well, that's all for now. At our next meeting, I hope to be able to tell you more of the secrets of Scotland Yard.
That's going to do it for the show this week. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find more Sherlock Holmes, Scotland Yard, past episodes of this podcast, and all the others at relicradio.com. Also, a link there to our Shoutcast stream and our donate button if you'd like to help support it all. Thanks, as always, to those who have, and thanks for joining me today. Be back next Wednesday with another episode of Case Closed. Case Closed is produced by and for relicradio.com. Rebroadcast of this show without permission is strictly prohibited.